The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Loken, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals on a snowy winter day. Today is February 4th, 2021. We have five cases on our calendar today, three oral and two non-oral. We are hearing the oral cases on the Zoom platform in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The same procedures apply to the Zoom oral arguments as apply to in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal is keeping the time. You can see the timer on a screen in one of the grid views. And if there's any issues seeing it, the clock, please let us know during the argument. Hopefully it's visible for you. The oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals. No other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. The first case on our calendar today is Robert Jensen et al. Versus Carl Rindelob et al. A20-1084. I'll ask counsel to identify yourself and the party you represent when you begin your oral argument. Appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tom Atmore on behalf of the appellants, Jane and Robert Jensen. In this case, the Jensens are asking that the court reverse the district court judgment and decision denying the motion for a new trial and remand the case for further proceedings. The case involves the Jensens' homestead and an easement that runs across that homestead. The Jensens have lived at 99 Delwood Avenue since 1978. The easement comes across the property to the shoreline from the road and comes very close to their house. And this proceeding was started because after over 70 years of only pedestrian use on the easement, after the Rindelobs purchased the property in 2014, and within a few years, we're using ATVs, cutting trees and brush, installing a metal boardwalk, a large metal boardwalk, putting in a dock and putting the lifts and the docks up on the Jensen's property during the winter months. And so after 70 years of limited use, there was a big change. And the Jensens asked the Washington County District Court to make a determination as to what kind of easement this was and what scope of use would be allowed on it. And we've set out four areas where we think the district court erred. And the first is an evidentiary ruling in which the judge precluded evidence of practical construction of the easement, also referred to as historical use of the easement. And the judge circumscribed the potential evidence the court would allow, contrary to Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, saying that the inquiry really should be broad and expansive. And as a result, the Jensen's case was prejudiced because witnesses were not allowed to testify. The Jensens were not allowed to testify about what happened over the years when the Bingers, who owned the property before the Rindelobs, were their neighbors for 30 plus years. And so we think it was an error of law and an abuse of discretion for the court to preclude this evidence. The touchstone cases are the Kretz case, Kretz v. Fireproof Storage, and that's found at 149 Northwest 648, and also Farns v. Lane, and that's at 161 Northwest 2nd 297. And the language in Farns is, yes, Your Honor.
The evidence that the Jensens proposed to present related to the scope or use of the easement, not the nature of the easement. Is that correct? In other words, it related to how the easement was used, not whether the easement was appurtenant or engross.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And that's a key point to understand, because I think that highlights where the district court erred. And if you look at the district court's decision at pages 16 and 17 of the November 22nd, 2019 motions in limine hearing, you can see where the court conflates the issues that Judge Cochran just brought out. And that is, there's the issue of what kind of easement is it, and then the issue of the scope of that easement. And historical use and practical construction goes to the latter issue. And at pages 16 and 17 of the November 22 transcript, the court says, quote, "I don't agree that the historical use of the easement somehow controls or is relevant to the type of easement that it is," close quote. And the issue the court had in mind there based on that statement is, what kind of easement is this? And and the court was blocking the evidence that went to the other issue. And that's where the error was made. And if you look at the Farns cases, Farns case and Kretz, the inquiry should be broad and expansive. And in Farns at page 300 of the Northwest Second Reporter, the court notes that whenever you have a general grant of a right-of-way easement, it is by definition ambiguous as to the scope of use. And so you apply the principles of ambiguous construction of ambiguous contracts. But the court goes on and says, but in addition, you look at the evidence relating to the particular easement at issue. And because the assumption is that the intended permitted use was reasonable and that the grantee's expectations are consistent with the purpose of the easement. And so you look at what they did over time on that easement. And you go beyond just the limited issues that you might address only in an ordinary contract situation. Easements are different. And the court goes on at page 301 of that decision to list a number of questions that the district court on remand in that case. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Judge Cochran, you're muted.
Thank you. Still learning. In the court's order on the Jensen's motion for a new trial, the court seemed to reevaluate how it addressed that question and then said that any historical use evidence the Jensen's offer in this case must have a demonstrable nexus to the easement's original parties. How was that a legal error?
Well, for two reasons. One is the case law doesn't refer to the requirement of such a nexus. You won't find that in Farns. You won't find it in Kretz. In fact, the law and the analysis in those cases is really to the contrary. You look at almost everything. For example, in Farns, they looked at what other people with other easements on the lake were doing at the time in terms of allowing docks. The issue in that case was whether or not the grantee could put in a dock. So the second thing, and we addressed this in our reply brief, is there is a nexus. The same family owned the dominant estate for over 70 years. The Wands were the initial grantees. Their daughter is Elizabeth Binger, and their son-in-law is Charles Binger. And those are the people that own the dominant estate for the entire time until the Rindelaubs purchased from the Binger Trust. So there is a nexus here, even if that were a requirement.
And the evidence you were proposing to present related to the Binger's use, is that correct?
It related to all uses, but yes, in particular with the Binger's, because they had been the neighbors of the Rindelabs for 30 plus years before the sale to the Rindelabs. But you can also look at the issue at the use prior to the Binger's taking the property under the Farns decision in Kretz. You look at the entire historical record of use. I want to touch briefly on some other issues in the case as well. Our second issue is that the court erred in concluding that the easement was appurtenant as opposed to engross. And the evidence doesn't reasonably support this conclusion. The court said, well, this easement runs with the land and is appurtenant, but the problem is twofold. There's no such language in the easement indicating that it is appurtenant. It doesn't say it runs with the land. It doesn't use the word appurtenant, and it doesn't describe the benefited parcel. So the key language is missing. So at best, it's ambiguous. Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you. Sorry, I just realized that. I think you just answered the question I was going to ask, which is it your position that the easement language is ambiguous? Because that wasn't clear to me from your brief.
So the language as to what type of easement it is has to be ambiguous because it doesn't use the words appurtenant or runs with the land. It doesn't describe the benefited parcel. And it doesn't say
in case law that requires that though, in order for it to be unambiguous?
No, Your Honor, and you're quite right. There isn't, but that leads to my next point. And that is you combine the absence of the necessary language with the events of how the easement was created in 1941. And so when the easement's created in 1941, first it's in a warranty deed. The warranty deed doesn't contain the necessary language either. But then they take it out of that warranty deed and put it into a separate standalone quitclaim deed that again contains none of the magic language about it being appurtenant or runs with the land or describes a benefited parcel. So I think you need to keep in mind too that the Hermstead Company, the grantor, was in the business of buying and selling real estate. They would certainly know, it can be assumed, how to create an appurtenant easement. The law was settled at the time, 1941. They would have known how to do it. But they didn't. The parties really did the exact opposite of what you would expect if this was intended to be an appurtenant easement. And then you go to 1969 because half of the easement had been extinguished essentially and then got reinstated in 1969 during the course of the Kalert and the Binger. Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that we would only look at other documents besides, or we would only look at other documents if we conclude that the language in the easement itself is ambiguous? In other words, you're asking us to look at another document from 1941. Is that appropriate? Do we only get there if the language is ambiguous?
Yes, you only get outside the quitclaim deed, the 1941 quitclaim deed, if you determine that it's ambiguous as to what type of easement that it is. And so I would agree with that, Your Honor. But I think the issue is, since it has none of that magic language about appurtenant, the court should not have concluded that it was. The court really added language in its decision that wasn't in the quitclaim deed in 1941. It's not in the quitclaim deed in 1969. And so that's the trouble that we ran into in this case and why I think the court was incorrect. The court says, well, the doctrine of merger may explain this variety of deeds in 1941, but the doctrine of merger does not. It has no applicability, and it didn't in 1941. So that can't be the explanation. And so on the face of this quitclaim deed, it is not appurtenant. It does not say it. It does not contain any of the language or terms that you would expect to find when someone intended to create an appurtenant easement. I want to jump in my remaining time just to the issue of claim preclusion. The court found that collateral stop that the decision as to appurtenant versus engross had already been decided in 1969. That's something you can review de novo. And I'll note that under the analysis, what the court and the Rindelobs advocated and what the court concluded was that because the Bingers pled appurtenance, that means that it is appurtenant. And that is not claim preclusion law. Under claim preclusion, it's the decision that controls. And there was no decision here that this was an appurtenant easement. That was not part of the stipulation the parties signed. It did not get into the quick claim deed that was granted by Kalert to the Bingers. And so, I mean, if every party could say, well, I pled it, so that means you're barred from forever arguing it again. I see my time is up. If I could have one more minute, Your Honor.
You can finish that thought. Thank you.
Thank you. If any party could say, well, I pled it, so I'm the victor, that turns claim preclusion law on its head. The Bingers didn't succeed in 1969. We think the court got that wrong as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Frank, appearing on behalf of the respondents in this case. May it please the court, opposing counsel. This case is about a short, simple easement. It's a right-of-way easement to and from White Bear Lake. It's 15 feet wide, and it includes, quote, the right to maintain the usual dock facilities. That's it. I mean, that's basically all the terms in this easement. You heard a lot of argument about what sort of extrinsic evidence should have been allowed at the trial. What you didn't hear a lot about was whether extrinsic evidence should have been allowed at all. This easement is not ambiguous as to any of the three issues that were raised in the original petition. The easement is silent on those issues, but under the case law, silence does not equate with ambiguity. And if it did, what you'd see is easement agreements that were 50 pages long that looked like construction contracts that addressed every conceivable dispute that might come up during the life of an easement. Easement agreements don't look like that, and there's a reason for that. It's the case law, and I'll get into more detail on that later in my argument.
Mr. Frank, I think Judge Larkin has a question for you.
Oh, sorry about that. I didn't see that. Go ahead, Your Honor.
That's okay. Just one quick question before you proceed with your argument. Is there evidence in the record suggesting that your clients were unable to use the easement for ingress and egress in its current state and that construction of a boardwalk was necessary to facilitate use?
Yes, there is evidence in the record on that, Your Honor. I don't have the index numbers in front of me as far as that, but if you look at the proceedings on the motion for a temporary restraining order at the very beginning of the case, that should be addressed in those documents.
Could you just tell the court briefly what the evidence is showing that egress and ingress was not possible without construction of a boardwalk?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence is essentially that the easement is a wetland. We had wetland delineations, but the expert testimony that was excluded in this case was related to that. A large portion of the easement is very wet, swampy, muddy, and extremely difficult to traverse without some kind of improvement. All right, so this case comes before the court as an appeal from a proceeding subsequent to initial registration of land. But really at its core, what this case is just a declaratory judgment action concerning the Go ahead, Your Honor. Do you still have your hand?
Judge Larkin, you're muted.
That was unintended. My apologies.
All right. So at its core, this case is just a declaratory judgment action regarding the meaning of a short, simple easement document. The petition raised three issues here. Was the easement appurtenant or engrossed? Does the easement prohibit improvements? Does the easement prohibit motor vehicles? Easements are interpreted just like contracts. That's what the case law says. Extrinsic evidence is only allowed if the easement's ambiguous. Again, the silence of the easement as to these issues does not mean it's ambiguous. There's no dispute the easement here. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
With regard to the use of the easement, doesn't the Farns case instruct that it is ambiguous? Because in Farns case addressed a similar issue where there was a right-of-way to a lake, and the court said, whereas here the easement for a way is granted in general terms, it's ambiguous. And here we have an easement that's granted in general terms.
I would direct the court to Giles v. Luker. I think Giles v. Luker addresses this issue. If an easement's granted in general terms, perhaps it may be ambiguous as to certain issues. It's not these issues as far as improvements in motor vehicles, it's not ambiguous. Let me quote Giles v. Luker here. Quote, a right-of-way arising by grant, which is not restricted by the terms of the grant, is available for the reasonable uses to which the dominant estate may be devoted. And that really resolves the issue here. What's reasonable is what's allowed. And so, and I guess the other condition would be what's allowed on the dominant estate. So if the Jensens have the right to build improvements and drive motor vehicles on their property, then the same rights are available to the easement holders, provided the use is reasonable. Those are the only two restrictions, unless there's a specific restriction in the easement grant. And so
Mr. Frank, the Giles case predates Farns by approximately 25 years. So isn't Farns the more recent, more instructive case then?
Farns is the more recent case, Your Honor, but Farns did not deal with the same issues as to the scope of the easement as dealt with in this case, as far as the right to use improvements or motor vehicles. And so I think Giles is still good law and the court can still rely on that. So moving on, as to the Jensen's argument as to the nature of the easement, the case there is even weaker for them. The easement's not silent on that point. The easement actually specifically says that it's not an easement in gross. An easement in gross is not alienable. It's not assignable. You can't sell it. You can't trade it. You can't pass it to your heirs. It's personal. It's assigned to one person and that's it. The easement here says that it's granted to the parties. It's granted to their assigns. It's granted to the survivor of the parties and the heirs and assigns of that survivor forever. And it says it's a perpetual easement. None of those things are compatible with an easement in gross. So the easement here actually has a series of terms that specifically say that it's intended to be an easement appurtenant and specifically disclaim the idea that it's an easement in gross that was personal to the Wands, the original grantees of the easement. And also you have the case of Weigerding versus Zegnego. And that case indicates basically that an easement is presumed to be appurtenant as long as there's any reasonable way that it can be construed as such. And clearly there's a reasonable way that it can be construed that way in this case. And so again, the court should begin this analysis by looking at, is this easement even ambiguous in the first place? But if the court were to conclude that the easement was ambiguous as to any of these three issues, then we get to the issue of whether this evidence that was excluded at trial should have been excluded. So this easement was granted in 1941. The Jensens purchased the property in 1978. And the testimony that was excluded, that they actually included in their offer of proof to the district court, was testimony of what the Jensens observed during the period of time they owned the property. So there was a question earlier on about what that evidence was. It was evidence of the Bingers' use, these successors in interest. There was never an offer of proof as to anyone who was testifying about the use of the lawns. That evidence was not excluded. It was not available. And so I think the way to look at this, I think it's true that case law does not directly address whether this type of evidence is admissible or relevant or not, but we look to the purpose. What do we use extrinsic evidence for when we're evaluating an ambiguous document? The purpose is to discover the party's intent, and specifically the party's intent, and specifically at the time they were entering into the contract. And so what does the use of a subsequent party, a successor in interest, that's occurring in 1978 or later, tell us about the intent of the parties when they entered into the easement agreement in 1941? I'd submit to the court, it tells us absolutely nothing about that, and it's irrelevant. It doesn't get at the issue that we're trying to prove.
Mr. Frank, isn't this case a little unusual in that the Bingers, Mrs. Binger is the daughter of the grantees and lived on the property with the original grantees? So isn't her use reflective of an understanding of the family's use of the property and the original grantees' understanding of the intent of the scope of the grant?
I would say no, Your Honor, because there's no evidence in the record that she was involved in any way with the 1941 grant of the easement. And again, what we're looking for is what was the party's intent at the time they entered into that contract? What were they thinking when the document was being executed? And so I do not believe that changes the analysis.
Well, respectfully, doesn't Farnes and Kretz suggest that the relevant evidence is broader than what you're suggesting? The scope of relevant evidence is broader.
Well, first, I would say that we only get to this question again if the easement's found to be ambiguous. But I don't believe that Farnes says specifically anything about a successor in interest, their use of the easement being relevant. I don't think Farnes contains that holding at all. What I'd also say is that, even if the court finds an ambiguity, and even if the court finds that there's some relevance here, the court's decision can also be affirmed under Rule 403 of the Rules of Evidence. I call the court's attention to, in appellant's brief, they brought up this issue of abandonment again, that they tried to put in front of the district court without including in their pleadings. This whole question of abandonment is a prejudicial inference, which was the one possible purpose of trying to get this evidence before the district court. Abandonment of an easement requires both evidence of non-use and evidence of an affirmative intent to abandon the easement, which was not in this case, which is why it was not part of the proceedings at district court. And so there's prejudice here in allowing this easement to come in, allowing this evidence of extrinsic use to come in. And there's the probative value, to the extent that exists, and I don't believe it does, is so slight, so tiny, that it cannot possibly outweigh that prejudicial effect that allowing that evidence in would have. One other thing I wanted to address in appellant's reply brief, they argued it was somehow inconsistent that use evidence would be excluded while extrinsic evidence of the 1968 Hermstead Company deed. That's the deed where the Hermstead Company announced that their intent was to create an appurtenant easement, that that was somehow inconsistent. First of all, I call the court's attention to the fact that the Hermstead Company deed was a trial exhibit, and every trial exhibit in this case was admitted into evidence by stipulation. So first of all, there's no issue there. Second of all, the Hermstead Company deed was evidence of the original party's intent. It was evidence of the Hermstead Company's intent of what they intended in 1941 when the easement was being created. And so that's completely different than evidence of a successor in interest use of the easement. And as I'm running out of time here, I will quickly address the issue of res judicata collateral estoppel. The court needs to look at the context of what was happening in that litigation and the pleadings. The Kalerts were attempting, and in their pleadings state that this is a personal easement. It no longer exists because the Wands have passed away. The Bingers responded to that saying, no, it's an appurtenant easement. We are the owners of this easement. And it was resolved by settlement, but part of that settlement was a quitclaim deed in which the Kalerts, quote, recognized, confirmed, and reestablished of record the 1941 easement. So that quitclaim deed is an acknowledgement. It's part of the outcome of that litigation that the easement was appurtenant. They were agreeing that the easement was not extinguished, which it would have been if it was personal to the Wands, if it had been an easement in gross. And so the court made the correct decision on that. The issue of appurtenant or in gross had already been litigated, and the court should be affirmed on that issue. I'll leave the expert witness issue to my brief, and unless the court has any questions, that concludes my argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Atmore, do you have any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Let me address some of the questions that Mr. Frank was asked. And I think during the course of the argument, the two issues, the two main issues, the type of easement and the scope of easement, again, got conflated and put together when talking about what sort of evidence comes in, what should be excluded. Judge Larkin asked Mr. Frank for evidence suggesting that the easement couldn't be used for ingress and egress absent the boardwalk. And Mr. Frank referred to wetland delineation and other type of evidence. I'll note that if you look at the motions in limine and the results from that, that evidence was excluded at the request of the Rindelobs. And they did not allege that they couldn't use the easement in its current condition. What they simply asked was that the court and the judge below noted this in her decision and in the new trial motion decision. They simply asked that they be declared to be the holders of the easement. That's it. They were not asking the court to declare that they didn't have full ingress and egress rights, nor did they ask the court to declare that they could build a boardwalk. So that those issues were in fact excluded from the trial. The next point was the question from Judge Cochran about the Farns case, and the response was, well, Giles says you don't considered it. I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't see you.
Well, Judge, I think Larkin, we had two hands up here. Okay. I'll defer to Judge Larkin first, and then maybe we can get to me.
I just want to follow up on the response you gave about ingress and egress being possible. The reason I asked the question is I believe there is case law saying if you have an easement for ingress and egress, and it's necessary to construct or develop or maintain it in order to be able to use it, that's a basis to construe an easement as allowing that improvement. So, but what I hear you saying is that wasn't the issue that was litigated below. This wasn't a case where, you know, an argument was made like, hey, under the law, we're entitled to maintain and develop this so we can use it for its intended purpose, and we're not able to do that. So is that a accurate description of what we would find in the record?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the evidence that went to those issues was excluded from the trial. I'll point out that the Giles case was limited. Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'm just going to jump in before you move on to discussing the Giles case, Mr. Atwater, with my question. And I think I heard Mr. Frank say that there was not an offer of proof as to what the probative historical use evidence would be in this case. Was there such an offer of proof? And what is the probative historical use evidence that you were not permitted to present?
Yes, there was a offer of proof. And I think what Mr. Frank was saying is that it didn't extend what was proposed, didn't extend past the ownership, beyond the ownership of the Bingers. In other words, during the period of the Wan's ownership. I don't think that's true because the Jensens can testify as to the condition of the easement over time when they got there. And in fact, that does, although it may not have tremendous weight, it is relevant to the issue of, well, what condition was it in at the time? Yes, Your Honor. Judge, is your hand up again? I'm sorry. Okay. So,
Mr. Atmore, in your
yes.
limited time left, I have a question for you too.
Yes.
Why isn't it reasonable to interpret the easement as a unambiguous broad grant for ingress and egress, as Mr. Frank suggested? In other words, if the parties had intended to limit it to foot traffic only, wouldn't they have included that? And given that it's very broad, shouldn't it just be interpreted as such?
So the and I see my time is up, if I may answer. Your Honor.
You may, thank you.
Yes, so I think Farns, Kretz, and other cases we cited in our brief answer that question. And that is that silence does not equal lack of ambiguity. In other words, if you simply say, well, it doesn't say I can't drive a tank down your easement, I get to drive a tank down your easement. That's not the law. The law says that when it doesn't state the scope of use, you need to look at what the parties reasonably intended the scope of use to be and the purposes of the easement. What's it for? What did they intend? What's the burden on the, what's the impact on the burdened estate? What's the need on the for the dominant estate and all those issues? And so that's why that is not a correct statement of what the law says. Silence does not equal free license to do whatever you want. You have to look at what was intended and what the purposes and scope of the easement was intended to be by the parties that made it. And that's exactly what Farns says.
Okay.
With
thank
that,
you.
Your Honor, we ask that you reverse the district court. Thank you.
Any further questions from the panel? All right, thank you both for your arguments, both oral and written. The case is submitted.